Hospitality. There's something about real good hospitality, right? Somebody taking care of you and your family. Has anybody ever experienced such good hospitality? It's a thing. It really is. I remember when Sonia and I lived in Atlanta, my parents came to visit us from Minnesota, and we thought, you know, we've been here for a couple years now. We want to show them some real good Southern hospitality. Like, it kind of got into our blood. And we wanted to take them to a place where they can get some good old Southern cooking, give them a taste of the city. And I'll never forget the experience we had at this historic Atlanta restaurant once we arrived. The place was packed. It was overflowing. It was one of those places where you'd go in, and there were pictures of celebrities, like, all over the wall. Every time they dined there, they had their picture taken, you know, with a rack of ribs or whatever it was. And, you know, they'd autograph the photo. It'd get plastered up on the wall. But the place was overflowing. It was so packed, in fact, that we were seated up against a wall and we were hardly able to move, like arms pinned to our sides, hardly able to move. But the food was supposed to be so good that it didn't really matter to us. And as we were eating, this older Southern lady kind of walked around from table to table giving people back rubs. And she kind of looked and sounded like Paula Deen. And I'm not too big into strangers coming up and like touching me. You know, I'm okay with hugs and stuff like that. But I kept thinking, oh God, don't let her come over to me, please. There's literally no space to move in this place. Why is she doing this? You know, does she work here? Is she the manager? Is this a show of Southern hospitality that I'm unfamiliar with? Giving somebody a back rub when they're eating food? I don't know. And sure enough, she squeezed past a table to come over to my family and I. Like, we could barely move. She asked someone to move so she could get behind our table to give everybody a back rub. She went around us clockwise, first to my dad, giving him a back rub. I looked at his confused face. It's like we had this psychic conversation back and forth. What's happening? I don't know. Did we order this? No, I ordered the ribs. And then she went on to rub my mom's back. And my mom is so sweet, she just kind of, I don't know, just kind of shrugged it off. And then she came over to me, and I was literally in this inaccessible part of the table, like pinned against the wall, wedged in the corner. And she found her way in there. So this over-the-top show of Southern hospitality was beyond uncomfortable to me. But it seemed like an important thing for her to do, so we let her do it. We weren't going to, you know, tell her off or something like that. But I will tell you, when I got home after that, I immediately went to Google to make sure that this wasn't some stranger like going around and rubbing my family's backs when we ate. It turns out that she was the hospitality chairperson of the restaurant. And she was supposedly famous for her back rubs. She went out of her way and went above and beyond to do what she could to make people feel like they were walking into their own kitchen. You know, getting welcomed home by grandma or something like that. To make them feel special, to make them feel like an honored guest. So this unlikely character, this stranger, went from table to table really helping people in a way, making small talk, welcoming them, making them feel like the only person in the room. And the reason why I share this story is because it made me so uncomfortable at the time. Her show of hospitality made me so uncomfortable, it kind of makes me understand why Judas in our story talks the way that he talks and acts the way that he acts. Because in our gospel lesson from John, Mary rubs Jesus' feet with perfume. And Judas is not just uncomfortable with the intimacy of this act, but he's uncomfortable with the over-the-top nature of it, thinking the money or the perfume could have been more suitable than the foot rub. So as we continue our Lenten sermon series of Jesus at the Border, I wonder what this might broaden in us about our take on hospitality. Our take on hospitality. And I think our scripture today can give us insight into hospitality for the other and about whom Jesus invites to participate in his story. And I think this is something we can all take away from here today and live out at home at work, at school, and maybe even here as a church. So, our story today brings us closer to the cross than ever before. We have heard that it is 6 days before the Passover lamb would be slaughtered in Jewish culture and at this high holy time. And Jesus came to Bethany, to the hometown of his friend Lazarus. His friend Lazarus, one that he had raised from the dead. His friend who had been dead for 3 days. Okay. Really dead. And gathered in this poor friend's home, they share a meal together in this intimate space. Martha, one of Jesus' friends, she served the meal, she prepared, she did things behind the scene in her own way. Lazarus shared the meal with them and was a friend. And Mary of Bethany shows this extravagant, over-the-top hospitality and love to Jesus in her own way. She takes a pound of nard, this costly perfume that we hear in Bible studies and things like that, would be worth like a year's wages in manual labor. And she anoints his feet. She drenches his feet with this. This isn't just like a spritzing at the perfume counter at Macy's or something like that. She is down at his feet using her hair, not her hands, to rub this precious ointment over him. And these are feet. You don't just let anybody touch your feet, you know. So my son is beginning to climb on things. He actually climbed the steps. He's one. The steps into the church this morning. About 16 months now, and my wife and I have been talking about bringing this thing back up from our basement, and I kind of dread it. It's called the Learning Tower. The Learning Tower. What is a Learning Tower? Well, the Learning Tower is this big step. It's kind of like a ladder that has a guardrail around it so your kid can help you. So they can help you, they can experience things, they can learn. They can stand at the counter in the kitchen or in the sink and splash, and you don't have to worry about them falling down and hurting themselves. And the reason why I loathe this thing is because it is always where it's not supposed to be in the house. And it's huge. It's always where you wouldn't expect it to be. So if I get up to use the restroom at night or get a drink of water in the kitchen, I will run into this thing like full force. And by physics, I end up injuring myself really badly. Always. I remember one time a couple years ago when we had this for our daughter, I rammed into this thing in the middle of the night, and it made my toenail turn purple. Toenail turned purple. And I was running a few days later, and I looked down at my shoe, and I'm like, oh, that's blood. I could see through my shoe. That's not good. So what did I do? I took a picture of it and sent it to my wife while she was at work, so she could see my bloody, gross foot. The reason why I share this is because we don't show our feet to just anybody. It has to be someone that you're close with, I think, or a podiatrist or a doctor. But in this story, Mary gets up close and personal with Jesus' feet. And Judas, who I think we always have to remind ourselves, Judas is one of Jesus' friends, one of his disciples. He's uncomfortable. He says what I think many of us would say. Why would you allow her to use all this perfume on your feet? This could have been sold for a whole year's wages, given to the poor. And the thing is, Judas may have been kind of embarrassed by this experience. You can kind of feel him getting flushed in the face, maybe taken aback by what Jesus was allowing this woman to do. Because this was a poor woman. This was a woman that wasn't married to him. She's down touching his feet in an intimate, personal, loving way, in a time and a place when it was taboo for men and women to be touched, or for men to be touched by a woman, okay? And in a time and a place where you would scarcely have two people of the opposite sex talking to each other in person, in public, unless they were together. And women's loose hair was perceived as this kind of sensual thing by heterosexual men in this culture, kind of like showing off cleavage or something like that. So Judas, in a way, is kind of bothered by what is happening here. You could practically feel his cheeks getting red with embarrassment. Should you be doing this? He probably thought. But Jesus defends Mary. See, for him, women were more than objects. They were more than baby-rearing machines or vessels. He doesn't have a problem being touched by them or seeing them with their hair down or women talking to men about being active in their bodies and with their senses. To him, in God's realm, women and men are equal in an intellectual and spiritual level, I believe. And God calls women as well as men to participate in God's salvation work in the world and to participate in Jesus' story. But what a novel idea, right? I wonder if this take on hospitality might broaden our understanding in church of whom Jesus might ask to participate in his story. I wonder. And so Jesus says to Judas, "Leave her alone. She bought it that it might be kept for the day of my burial. You'll always have the poor, but you won't always have me with you." So what is Jesus saying when he says that? Maybe you heard that verse and you shut down. Maybe that sounded like a prosperity gospel verse or something, you know, where Jesus is putting down the poor. You'll always have the poor. Well, I don't think that is what Jesus is saying. He's not dismissing the fact that poor people will always exist, but he's dismissing Judas's excuse, I think, for critiquing this act of love and this important act of hospitality in Mary doing what she does. I think Judas thinks what many of us are tempted to say when it comes to conversations about hospitality and welcome. When we hear about suffering groups of people, immigrants and asylum seekers, we have all heard these conversations. Maybe we have participated in them as well. Why should we care about this group when we have suffering people here? Why should we care about this group when there are homeless people or starving children or homeless veterans or something like that? What about this group? What about that group? What about ism at its finest? What about the poor, Jesus? Why are you letting her do that? Shouldn't we focus our money and our energy somewhere else, Jesus? I think Judas says what is probably on the tip of many of our tongues in our national conversations. But I think in Jesus saying, "You'll always have the poor," he basically is saying, "You know what, Judas? You know what, all y'all? You know what, Pastor Stark? You have infinite opportunities to pour out your love lavishly for the poor and for the suffering all the time. All the time. But now, right now, you bring it up? Perhaps you will always have the poor," Jesus is saying. "But don't pit one group of people against the other. Don't pretend this is really about poor people. It's about your own discomfort in this moment. Suffering people are not the enemy of other suffering people." I wonder if hearing Judas's words through this lens and Jesus's words through this lens might give us a different way of understanding the false equivalencies that we fling around in social media and in our arguments at the dinner tables. And it might help us think that hospitality towards the other is the right thing to do all the time, not just when it's convenient. And that you should care about all these suffering groups of people, not just one when it comes into focus. You should care all the time. Extend hospitality all the time. Besides all this, what Mary does is more than just using perfume on Jesus' feet or some expensive perfume that could have been sold. Jesus is prepared for death by Mary in this story. She is rubbing down his body like one would do with herbs and oils to prepare them for death or burial. Whether she knows it or not, she anoints him for the hardest hour to come. Mary anoints him and prepares him for the tomb. And the odd thing about this is that anointing was something that happened to kings, to priests, with lavish oils and perfumes being poured over their heads. And in this story, it's not his head that gets anointed, as he is not a king like any other king, but his feet, his stinky, dirty feet. Remember that Jesus is the upside-down king, one who does not come to rule but to serve. But by doing this, by intimately doing this, it says something about who Jesus was, who God chooses to participate in Jesus' story. It isn't a pope or a king or a priest or even one of his male disciples that anoints Jesus, But rather here we have Mary of Bethany, this woman from a countryside town, a hardworking layperson, not someone in the inner circle of Jesus' disciples. Not even Judas. We don't even have someone who is the picture-perfect person of faith who's preparing Jesus for this moment in his life. This is Mary who, I don't know if you remember the story, but she witnessed Jesus raise her brother Lazarus from the dead. And before he was raised, she falls down to his feet and says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." This is the same Mary that doubts, the same Mary that gets mad at God, the same Mary who gets mad at Jesus, who has real emotions and real struggles and a real family and real pain. This is the same Mary whose life at times stinks and who knows the reality of death and loss and what it is like to have people look down on her. And this is the one that God uses to prepare God's only Son for Christ's most difficult hour. And she does what she does by extending extravagant hospitality and love to Jesus in her own way. I wonder if this might provide us with insight for what's happening in our country and our world. When we are tempted to buy into the rhetoric that the other may be an invader or subhuman, that they do not have anything to contribute to the world, I wonder if we might think of Mary, an unlikely vessel for this most important task, and how God chose her for this critical role in caring for God's beloved. So, with that being said, I think for all of us today in our personal lives, our life as a church community, we could look to Mary of Bethany as a story of inspiration. If we ever feel like God can't use us for anything, we're not big enough or important enough or smart enough or have enough money, that we're not faithful enough, perhaps we need to think again for Mary, this unlikely candidate, in what happens in the big picture of things, participates in God's story of salvation for the world. I'm hopeful her story can inspire us of a way that is different of thinking about the other. I don't know, maybe it will, maybe it won't. In all the different shapes and forms that the other takes in our world. Because God can use people who we wouldn't expect God to use for amazing things. Maybe even us. Maybe even you. And maybe even me. Because God invites all people, sinners and saints, people of all gender expressions and ages and races and tongues and backgrounds to the table. The God who makes rivers spring up in the desert does a new thing in this story in Mary. Jesus, who does a new thing on the cross and in the tomb, reminds Judas that this deflection and ours as well is short-sighted and incongruent with the realm of God, and that God may be calling us to do a new thing at home, at school, at work, at church, in the world. So my prayer for us this week is we can be hospitable to our neighbors, that our hearts can be touched, and we can remember who Jesus calls in his story and how that person doesn't always look like the person that's sitting right next to us in the pew. Amen.